Welcome to the Celtic Geek, the town crier for both kinds of entertainment, Celtic and geek. And my name is Mark Gunn, and I'm here with Michael Drought, Tolkien professor extraordinaire. Tell me about yourself, Michael.
Well, I'm professor of English at Wheaton College. I have been studying J.R.R. Tolkien's works for, 17 years as a professor and many years before that. And I've done some editing of his texts, his book Beowulf of the Critics, and edit the journal Tolkien Studies. And so I come to this is my third ALEP. It's an amazing experience to give a talk to people who are so involved and can teach me stuff back because they've tried to make it or build it or act it out. And it's a great interaction.
Yeah, I think you are one of the reasons why I'm also, when it came to like discussions and talks and such, I tell everyone, you gotta see Michael Drought, he's brilliant. So how long have you been doing this? How long have you been, studying Tolkien, and how long have you been teaching it as well?
Well, I'm a medievalist by training, just like Tolkien was. In fact, we sort of have the same day job, though he was at Oxford. But we teach Anglo-Saxon, Old English, we teach Middle English and Chaucer, we teach the history of language. And so I was sort of brought into that by Tolkien. I mean, I've been reading Tolkien since my dad read it to me aloud when I was 4 or 6 years old or something. And so I sort of fell into studying it, didn't intend to, looked at other things. And then after that, I wanted to work on Tolkien itself, and I was highly discouraged by my teachers and dissertation director and stuff. Like, you'll never get a job doing that. you got to show that you're doing serious stuff. And I kept working on it anyway because I was interested.
Right.
And then now I hear from people, you have it easy. You've got that Tolkien thing that's so trendy. And I'm like, make up your mind. Is it trendy or is it, weird and esoteric and you shouldn't do it? But in any event, I edited the text that he wrote about Beowulf. And that sort of led me into studying about Tolkien and editing the journal. And so I would say serious academic study of Tolkien probably over 20 years.
Wow.
And, and being a reader, a lifelong reader, so, 40 years or so of reading and loving Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and all Tolkien's other work.
Now, Beowulf, last time I remember you did a big talk about Beowulf, and what was the connection with Tolkien and Beowulf?
Well, that was Tolkien's academic specialty, was the poem Beowulf. He knew more about it than anybody at the time period, and maybe still. In 1936, he published a lecture called Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics, which completely changed Beowulf scholarship. Up to that point, people looked at Beowulf and I guess there's a poem and there's some monsters, but really what's interesting is all the history and culture, which is interesting, but they were using it to, try to reconstruct very early medieval history and not looking at it as a very good poem. They would compare it to Homer or Virgil and say, not nearly as good as Homer and Virgil. And Tolkien changed all of that in one lecture. He said, wait a second, here's why the monsters are important. Here's how the poem works as a two-part poem, but like with two divisions in the first part. So there's two monster fights. Beowulf fights a monster called Grendel, rips his arm off, then he fights Grendel's mother. Then 50 years later, he fights a dragon. And Tolkien said, you can't apologize for the monsters. The monsters are central. And this seems really obvious to us now, but it obviously wasn't in 1935. And so I was working on that, and I found that Tolkien had drawn that lecture from a book-length discussion, and the Tolkien Estate gave me permission to edit and publish that. Hmm. That happened to coincide, and I really mean happened to coincide with the Peter Jackson films. Because I had finished the manuscript 2 years before it was actually published. The press was so late, they missed the Fellowship of the Ring. I kept telling them, people would be interested in this. So they finally got it out in time for the Two Towers, but it had no connection. It had nothing to do with it. And then just from there, because your name is associated with the Tolkien thing, you start getting invitations to talk about it, and that's what happened with me in Beowulf. But the other reason Beowulf is so important for Tolkien is that it gave him a model of how you could sort of generate this a story that felt like it was a part of something bigger. And I don't think that the Beowulf poet did that on purpose. He just told his story, and it's now been so long and we're so separated from it that there's these little, he mentions a person's name where no idea who that guy is, which is what Tolkien did in his technique. He would say, oh yes, of course, and that was, Elrond says, Frodo, if you accept this quest, you'll be as great as Hador and Húrin and Túrin and Beren himself. Well, we don't know who Hador and Húrin and Túrin are at that stage in the story.
Right.
And so it gives us this feeling like there's something much bigger out there.
Right.
And Tolkien got that from Beowulf in some ways.
Yeah. Now, you kind of, again, you blew me away with a lot of your, how those things come together. Now, so Tolkien, when he created his world, how did it evolve? Can you explain a little bit about the evolution?
Well, he started off, he wanted to create these mythological stories. And you see these in the Silmarillion now. He thought there were sort of like three great stories, the fall of Gondolin.
Oh, okay, I'm going to pause right here and ask. Okay, so the Silmarillion was one of those things that I've not finished. I had said.
So did you really feel it was like a telephone directory in Elvish?
Yes.
That was the criticism of it.
How do you read it? How do you get to
there,
it?
There are some real. The Silmarillion can be really tough. One of the things is that there's too many characters whose names all begin with F.
Right.
And we call these the famous effing elves because there's six of them and they're all in the same family. And the part of the way it is reading the Silmarillion is you have to read it like this is really helpful to say. You have to read it like you read a Norse saga. You know, you have to read it like you read Beowulf, but that you have to figure out some of the conventions. So, like, all characters beginning with the same name usually indicates they're all in the same family. Instead of a last name. So instead of being just really, I can't remember if that's Finway or Fingon or Finrod or Fingolfin, the F can a little bit help. But my students, when I walk them through the Silmarillion, it's hard because it doesn't have this, it's not written like a modern novel like The Lord of the Rings is, and it doesn't have that mediating figure of the hobbits to, you know, the hobbits, when we read The Lord of the Rings, the hobbits are confused too.
Right.
The hobbits are like, who is this Queen Baruthiel? Well, they don't actually say that, but he's like, oh, you know, they'll lead you better than the cats of Queen Baruthiel.
Right.
And you would like to know what that is, but they seem confused also. And in many other places, too, you know, Saruman, and Frodo says, who's Saruman? As opposed to knowing everything. And the Silmarillion works like that, but without the Hobbit intermediary. It's just all the material.
Right.
So the way I teach students to read it is to sort of take it as independent, self-contained stories,
right,
and then try to build your own sort of story arc from them and what's happening. But it is a difficult task.
But you said to approach it like a Norse saga. Now, does that mean that would it be better? I mean, just random question. Then would it be better if you told me, you said last time that I was here, that Beowulf is best spoken as opposed to read. So would the Silmarillion be best
spoken? I don't know about that for the Silmarillion. I mean, for some of Tolkien's stuff, it is. I mean, Lord of the Rings and Hobbit are read-aloud books. I have read the Silmarillion out loud to my suffering children.
Actually,
my son asked. The Silmarillion's not made that way. And like one of the things that I've now learned about this, about reading lots of stuff out loud, is that certain The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, they're meant to be read out loud. They were read out loud to the Inklings or to Tolkien's kids. And so one of the tricks is that you always know which character is speaking before you start. So if you have to do voices, you don't have to change.
Yeah.
Silmarillion, not so much. There'll be a long, long paragraph by someone, and then you'll get to the end, and the person talking was not the person you did the voice of. And it's really confusing. But that's, and there's other texts like that. Frank Herbert's Dune, I'm reading that to my son right now. That's brutal. Because it's the same thing, except it'll be like four exchanges, and then he'll say who's talking, and you're like, oh, that's not who I thought was talking. So Silmarillion out loud, I would say no.
Okay.
I think it's more, when I say reading it like a Norse saga, the Norse sagas are all driven by underlying family rivalries. And you have to sort of look at the family tree and picture or draw on a, look at a map, who owns what land, and then a lot of it makes sense. And in fact, it works a lot like Game of Thrones. Uh-huh. And the Silmarillion is closer in content that way to Game of Thrones than it is to the Lord of the Rings. So it's not as detailed political machinations, you know, lots of hundreds of families and characters and stuff, but there's some big picture things that are similar that aren't in Lord of the Rings. Two very large, powerful families of elves that have sort of major divisions between them. They're all supposed to be fighting the same Dark Lord, but what's going on in the background is and there's like a jostling for position because the elves have ranks of who's a better elf.
Yeah.
And, of course, the best elves just live out in Valinor and sit around singing all day and don't do anything right, and aren't really part of the story.
Right.
But the other two kindreds of elves, the Noldor and the Sindar, a lot of the complexity of the story make more sense if you realize that the Noldor are supposed to rank higher than the Sindar in some way, but then they've gone away, the Sindar have gotten powerful, the Noldor come back, and the Sindar aren't exactly ready to say, oh yeah, go ahead, rule over us. And that drives a lot of it. And when you sort of explain it with the family trees and with the elf ranks, some of the things come in make sense. But yeah. It doesn't. I mean, I think that if Tolkien had lived another 20 years and it figured out the way he would have handled the Silmarillion was as translations from the Elvish by Bilbo Baggins and set up this frame of Bilbo explain something and then give the story. But yeah. He didn't. He died. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say if someone who died, you know, in his almost 80 years old, but yeah, right. he didn't have enough time. Right. He needed more time.
More time. That would have been awesome. So now, what is your favorite thing from the story, the series? I mean, before I even get to that. So, when did you start reading The Hobbit? I assume you read The Hobbit before you read Lord of the Rings to your kids.
Yes.
And when did you start reading Hobbit to your kids?
I think they were either 3 or 4. Wow. I think 4 for my daughter. And I think actually that they were read to her even younger, but they were by my wife, and it was just to put her to sleep.
Yeah.
Because she was a real pain about going to sleep. You needed to be reading something, but she would ask you questions about it.
Right.
So I started actually reading to her in Old English just to put her to sleep. And for a 2-year period, I read the entire Anglo-Saxon Poetic Records, all 32,000 lines of poetry, because it would put her to sleep every night. And then I recorded those and did a podcast of them. So if you want to listen to all 32,000 lines of Anglo-Saxon poetry, go to anglosaxonaloud.com and you can awesome. Hear it.
And you also have the Beowulf Aloud, too.
Beowulf Aloud CD. I recorded Beowulf. It's 3 hours and 17 minutes long in Anglo-Saxon. Awesome. But I've actually done, I think, 3 Beowulf marathons now where you get a bunch of people together and you read the whole poem in Anglo-Saxon. At MythCon this past summer, we did a collaborative reading of like the first third of Beowulf using Tolkien's translation. But I had both the translation and Old English books open up on the podium, and anyone who wanted to could come up and read a section from each one. And it took about an hour, and that was really fun too. But sorry, to go back to reading it out loud, I think that my daughter was 4. She might have been 5 when we read The Hobbit.
Nice.
And then we waited till she was a little bit older to read the Lord of the Rings. And my son, I think he was a little bit older still. He was probably like 5 and 6 or 5 and 7. And we're reading The Lord of the Rings out loud sort of every other night because my wife would read a different book.
Right.
It took about a year, I think, to work through The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Or close to, like, I think it actually was with my daughters that we somehow managed to be reading The Fall of Sauron on March 25th. And, like, some of the stuff had matched up, so it almost lasted, reading it almost lasted as long as the journey took, which was pretty cool. And to read it out loud, it's, you have to do voices, though.
Yeah.
You gotta have voices for your characters. Yeah. And, or at least that's what my kids said, and then if I did the voice wrong, I would hear about it.
Yeah.
You're not doing Gandalf right. Gandalf sounds too much like Thorin. Do Gandalf like Gandalf. And I'm sitting there like, how did I do Gandalf the last time?
That would be difficult. I do voices when I read to my daughter, but I can't imagine all the characters.
I think there was like sort of one generic Hobbit voice, and then maybe Sam got a different one. I think it went from there. I mean, really the voices that I've ever done are like Gandalf, dwarves. You know, you can just pick something, and I probably picked them based on the actor Nicole Williamson. If you remember the very old from the 80s Excalibur, he was Merlin in that. And back even before then, in the 70s, he had done an audio vinyl record of The Hobbit.
Oh, really?
And that's he cool. did voices like the dwarves had sort of Yorkshire accents, and Bilbo had kind of a West Midlands accent. Uh-huh. And I think I stole that a little bit, except I don't do the accents as well.
Right.
You got to have voices, though, whatever they are.
Awesome. So now back to my question a moment ago. What is your, is there a favorite moment that you, in the books, that stands out to you, and why?
That's a hard question.
I know.
I mean, you know, there's the action moments that are so great. I know, like, for a lot of my students, when Eowyn fights in Lord of the Nazgul, like, that's the moment in the book, or when Gandalf fights the Balrog.
What moved you the most?
Well, in terms of when I was a kid, Gandalf fights the Balrog. I cried my eyes out. I couldn't believe it. It's like, Dad, you read it wrong. It didn't happen. Gandalf can't die.
Bride.
Right, from the Princess Bride. No, he can't die.
Evil wins?
It's not right. So that was, and I always loved the Moria chapters anyway. I mean, it was just so amazing. But I don't know. I would say that probably what now stands out and really resonates so much for me is the Lothlorien chapter when Frodo and Aragorn are walking on Cairn Amroth, and it's just so beautiful and alive and different. And I think Tolkien is trying to get at something. I mean, he was hospitalized for a very long time after World War I with some kind of fever. And there is a sense, like, if you've ever, you know, been really sick and you look at the world and everything that you totally recognize, but it has this weird, like, it's like you're seeing it for the first time.
Right.
And that's how he describes Lothlorien there. And I think that he gets that remarkably. I mean, I think a lot of the elf stuff for me, the elves in Woodhall, yeah, in the Shire when they don't expect to see the elves, some of the Ithilien descriptions of how, you know, they weren't, again, it's, you've been having this horrendous, dangerous, terrible journey, and then you're in this, like, garden of Ithilien before then the scary stuff starts happening, yeah, again. So I love those moments, as well as the big, you know, the big battle scenes and, yeah, the breaking, you look back as a kid and I hated the scene where they broke down the gate with Grond, because, like, the bad guys are winning and, yeah, everything again, but I love the scene, the power of it, you, yeah, know, and the Black Rider riding under and Gandalf just sitting there and then.
Yeah.
And again, the Black Riders are just, they're remarkably stupid. They always forget to press their advantage, right? Like, right? We've stabbed Frodo a little bit. We've got them surrounded. There's nine of us. No, actually, there weren't nine. There were only five of them there. Right?
Right.
There's five of us with the Lord of the Nazgul. There's, like, one Aragorn and some hobbits. I know, let's withdraw and we'll get them another time. You know, or, like, you know, the Black Rider's about to ride in under the gate, and then he gets a message that, like, there's the Rohan is coming. Like, finish off Minas Tirith. And then, so it's good the bad guys are so tactically stupid.
But I think it's kind of as you describe it, though, while on the one hand, you know, you look at the modern storytelling and you're like, yeah, that's just dumb. Come on, guys. You know, you're, every time you see a movie like that, you're just like, are you serious? Come on. But, yeah, but
it's like the what's it called? The Dr. Evil.
Exactly.
No, we must build an incredibly complex trap that will be easy to escape from. Just shoot him.
We got a gun right here. Yes.
Exactly. We'll do it together.
but when you describe it, though, so the whole mythos here is it's got this huge arc of mythology. You know, I mean, it's so grand and beautiful, and I've some of the songs that I've written, I think of as when I feel like I really succeeded, they're like these great folk songs that are just not just, you know, a folk song that, you know, a love song or whatever, but it's got this world, this
it
whole.
It connects up with something larger.
Yeah.
Because that's what makes it seem, that's what makes it seem so believable and so real, is that everything with Middle-earth, there's something off the edge, there's something farther away, there's some other story that you could develop in it, which is a little bit like how, you know, Greek mythology worked,
right,
you know, or Norse mythology. There was the major story arcs, there was the religious part of it, and then someone would pick, like, one episode and say, hey, this is what must have happened in more detail there, and then you get the Odyssey and you get the Iliad and,
right,
so forth. And I think it's the same thing going on in Tolkien's world of Middle-earth, which is that you start to fill in the gaps. And then you have arguments or, you know, thought, well, what would have to be there? Like, how would they get their food, or how would they,
yeah,
and then what would the other stories around it be? And it really invites a kind of participatory culture,
yeah,
because there are bigger things to fit into. You're not limited by it. And part of that is the way Tolkien wrote it, and part of is the way he was influenced by Beowulf, that has these gaps and inconsistencies or things that seem conflicting, that there is probably some deeper truth behind it where they can both be true. So,
right,
you know, or the way the information is revealed to you, that it feels experiential rather than just reading a book. So, I mean, a good example would be the whole Moria thing. It starts out with nobody's ever heard of Moria.
Right.
And then Glowin says, yeah, my cousin Balin, we remember Balin, okay, and he went into Moria. We haven't heard from him in 20 years. Then they're hiking through the Redhorn Pass and stuff, and Gandalf and Aragorn are talking, and Frodo's overhearing them say, we should, you know, go in the dark road. I don't want to go in the dark road. What's the dark road? And then they finally say, oh, what's the Mines of Moria? And then we know where it is. Then we can't get in. Then once we get in, there's a hideous octopus monster at the front, but there's no dwarves inside. I doubt Balin ever came here. Then we get to the Chamber of Mazerbul, and oh, he did get here, and he was killed. But even then, it's all, we cannot get out, drums in the deep. Right. And even then, you get the drums in the deep, and you still don't know what it is, and you're running, and there's this, and there's something behind the door, we don't know. And then finally, the big reveal is the Balrog. And yeah. by that time, you've had to put all these pieces together, yeah. and there's been all these possible side roads and other information. And I mean, you realize that, just for an example, what you said about adding things to it or a folk song that's part of it. Right. You could, the story of everything that Balin and his company did in Moria for the 20 years that they were there before they were killed off, that's another Lord of the Rings book.
Right.
You know? And that's what I find remarkable about it. And it's kind of qualitatively different than a lot of other literature that it has those hooks and those places to tie in.
Yeah. It's amazing. Now you're working on a new book, right? What is?
Yeah, I'm trying. 2 years now. I've been saying I'm almost done with it. I feel like Tolkien, who kept sending letters to Alan and Unwin, saying I'm almost done with the sequel to The Hobbit. He did that when he was on Chapter 3, and he's like, I'm almost done. I probably have it done by Christmas. And like every year, it's like, oh, I've been sick, but I'm almost done. And I've had a lot of papers to mark, but I'm almost finished. And 17 years
I know
later,
people like that.
Yeah, 17 years, a long time to wait. But no, my book is called The Tower and the Ruin, and it's sort of arguing that those are the two key images in Tolkien, a tower off in the distance or something, and then a ruin that persists in the landscape, and arguing that really what Tolkien does with The Lord of the Rings is he produces a textual ruin in some sense. It's like when you look at a ruin, you can see in your mind's eye the building that was there.
Right.
And you also see, like, the picturesque pieces that were there. And that's sort of what he's doing with all these stories.
Yeah.
And the way The Lord of the Rings... And a lot of it, I don't know if it was intentional as much as it was that he wrote this giant archive of other mythology and stories, and then he could refer to it. And so it all made sense to him, and none of it conflicts with each other. But when we see it on our end, we have to piece it in together. So that book is pretty close to being done. And the final chapter, which is not close to being done yet, but it's the final one, so maybe, is about events like Aelep and things like the Lord of the Rings Online MMO game
right.
that I've done some consulting for. Because there's this, people want to go to Middle Earth, and they'll go to extraordinary lengths to do that. They'll make Middle Earth in Kentucky if that's what it takes to get there. And I mean, that's just, as a literary scholar, that's fundamentally different than
right.
I think, than anything that's existed in literature before. I mean, you can point to little things like, you know, the craze for Egyptology in the 19th century or some other things, but that widespread, and people have picked up on it all over the place, that participatory culture, you know, we call it fan culture or something. I think it's a way that some people try to demean it, though fans have taken back the
right.
word fan. But that sense of that you'll make things, and it's been going on. It went on long before the Peter Jackson movies. I mean, people were doing stuff, just not maybe to the same extent, or people didn't know that other people were doing it.
Yeah.
But I mean, even, you know, in the 1980s, I was making maps of my own imagined world or Middle Earth maps, and then distressing them. You know, I soaked them in lemon juice and ironed them to make them.
Nice.
Yeah, then I didn't clean the iron. And my mother, I think it was the last time I was hit, was that my mother took the iron and ironed lemon juice onto a blouse or something, and like, I think she smashed me with a yardstick. She was so, and
oh,
it
no.
broke, you know, so I was like, it's the last time I'll ever be hit with that. But, you know, that kind of, you know, to create, to make up music or painting or art or costumes or weapons or artifacts or something is something that just the field of literary studies does not know how to deal with, which is good because it's an opportunity to figure
yeah.
it out. But it's and it gives you a window, I think, into how culture gets created, how many minds. Like
yeah.
our model is the one lone guy sitting up in the attic, you know, scribbling something down with a quill pen, and that's only one model of authorship.
Right.
And then that might have even been Tolkien's model of authorship, except that he was sharing it with C.S. Lewis and
right.
the Inklings. But it's gone beyond that now, and it's really exciting. I mean, I think that it's from just a straightforward intellectual side, it's really exciting. And then when you participate or quasi-participate in it, and you get to go to these events and you see the joy that people are getting out of it and the amount of work and intellectual labor that they've put in to make a costume, to really, I mean, yes, of course, it's dress up and it's fun to dress up, but most of this work is done to entertain and amuse others who are looking at it. You're not looking at yourself unless, you know, short times when you're standing in front of the mirror, but most of the time it's for others.
Yeah.
It's just, it's kind of amazing. I really enjoy, I love this event particularly, but I really like it when, you know, people who are involved in the culture want to hear things from the snobby scholarly side too. It's a good convergence.
That's one of the things that's great about this. It's got everything. It's got that, you know, the music. We just wrote a dwarven dance. That's awesome.
A dwarven dance.
Yes.
You don't picture the dwarves dancing, but they must.
I know. We were just talking.
Every human culture has dance.
We were doing a dance class there, and I started playing this tune, Moria, by my old band, the Probably Not Game Bards, and then Samantha, our fiddler, says, "Wow, that's, I see these axes." I'm like, "Oh my God, I got to write this." So next thing you know, we sat down with a few other people and we wrote ourselves a little dwarven dance, which is just fun. It's awesome. One final question. What is your favorite thing that's happened? You've been here for, you know, the past all three ALEPs now. What is your favorite thing that you've seen, the best memory?
The best memory happened with the first one. Not to say that the other ones aren't good.
Yeah.
The first one, you and the Broadway Nagging Bards were playing, and people were hobbit dancing impromptu. I don't think it was trained or planned that time. And it was Bilbo's party, so the paper lanterns are up. And I wandered off into the field behind it to look at the stars, because the stars are, I mean, there's not a lot of light pollution out here. It's really beautiful. And to look at the stars, I was looking at the stars, wandered off, you know, until it got dark. And I turned around, and I saw this little circle of light, and your music was coming out of it, and people were dancing and having a great time. And in Tolkien's Beowulf, The Monsters, The Critics essay, he says this one line of those of us who live in the little circle of light can't forget the darkness that's all around, but it makes us love the light even more. And that was the little circle of light. I mean, I've been working on that text and studying that text for so long, and then just to see it, and it really was. It was a circle. It was happiness and joy, and it's not like, you know, the Shaker Village countryside is full of black riders and stuff like that. But it was just that contrast, and it was so beautiful.
Cosplay and, idea for next time.
Okay. I think the first one, didn't they have somebody dress up as a black rider ride through?
Yeah, that's right. They did. I remember
that. But, you know, it was the recreation of that, and that what it must have been like, I think, to be in, you know, for 1,000 years of history in the Middle Ages, unless you were living in a city, right? For 1,000 years, that was what joy was. It was the night, the one night out of every season that we had a big bonfire and had music and weren't just laboring and just joyful and having fun. And that was recreated without any of the, I mean, just for that moment at least, it's just this sort of pure human existence. And I just got something there. Yeah. So I've been, I mean, and there's moments like that all the time. Yeah. And I think that I tell the story and everyone's going to wander out in the field and be a big crowd of people.
I know.
It's not going to be the same. But that kind of, you know, the recapturing of the things. And I'm not like a, you know, I like my electric wiring and my plumbing and all of that stuff. But just sort of recapturing what most of human existence on this planet has been and where the joys are. And they don't have, you know, bells and whistles and electric things or whatever, and Tolkien's saying that about the Shire too, and just to recreate that for an hour is a pretty remarkable accomplishment that the guys who organized this have now done 3 times. So
so last question is, where can people find you online or
at MichaelDrought.com.
MichaelDrought.com.
It's Drought. There's no gh in it. So everybody puts it in there. And That has a link to all the other things, to like anglosaxonloud.com and my grammar book and books and stuff like that, and awesome. CDs.
So all right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it, too, and I love listening to your music.
Thanks. Sláinte.